Well, hello again, everybody out in Turdville. It is, today actually is the 19th of December, 2013. We are just 4 days away from a rather illustrious anniversary. That would be the 100th anniversary of the creation of the United States Federal Reserve System. As a real treat and honor, we have today as our Access to Access guest, the one and only G. Edward Griffin. If most of you, I'm sure, know who Mr. Griffin is, but he is the author of one of the most important books written about the Federal Reserve System called The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is a reference to the island where all the bigwigs got together and came up with this idea of the Fed in the first place. Book was written a long time ago, and many, many, many folks have read it. And it is, Ed, I called you yesterday the godfather of much of what we do. So, Mr. Godfather.
I like that. That's pretty good.
Thank you for, I wish we had the music in the background. Da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Ed, thank you so much for joining us here in Turdville.
Well, Craig, thanks for inviting me. I really appreciate it. And, I'll do my best to make my segment today of some value.
Well, it is a real honor. Tell us, before we really get started, tell us about that book and the circumstances, I guess, surrounding you writing it, what drove you to write it, your interest in all this in the first place.
That's really a much bigger topic than it sounds like it would be, and it's probably a lot less important than you'd think it would be, too, because like so many projects in life and so many turns in life, it doesn't all happen at once. You know, there are a lot of little things that nudge you along. And to make a long, boring story a little into a short, boring story, early on, it was probably 30 years ago or so, I decided I was going to produce a very low-budget documentary film on the subject of inflation. And I didn't know too much about inflation except that there was a lot of misconception. People thought that inflation was caused by the farmers getting too much money for their produce. Yeah. Farmers said, no, it's not us. It's the wholesalers who are gouging us. And the wholesaler says, no, it's the grocery stores that are making all the money. And the grocery stores say, no, it's the darn labor unions that are causing us to pay so much in wages. And everybody's pointing the finger at somebody else, and I knew that was wrong. And I also thought that it had something to do with the government, but I wasn't quite sure. So I decided that it was a good idea to learn about all of this and then take what I learned and produce a little documentary film. So I started to do my research. As I say, this was many years ago. And I got a couple of boxes full of books and articles and recordings from various people. And I never did produce the film because other things got in the way that seemed to be more important at the time. But I did have these couple of boxes full of research material, and I had learned a lot in a short period of time about all this. So then fast forward to about, 1980, something like that, some group in Pasadena, a very fine group of little old ladies in tennis shoes, as the saying goes. They really, I don't think they were wearing tennis shoes, but they were some little old ladies in Pasadena, and they had a study group on taxes. And they called me one day, and they asked me to give a speech, if I would, before their little study group on taxes. And I said, well, ladies, I don't know much about taxes, except that they're too high, and I'm a ginnam. But other than that, what can I say? But I could talk about a hidden tax called inflation, if you would like. And they said, oh yeah, that would be fine. So basically, I think they were just looking for a free speaker, and I was it. So I accepted the challenge and got those boxes out of the back of my closet and went through them and cobbled together a little outline for a presentation. Well, fast forwarding again, the ladies liked it, and they said, you should put that on the road. Well, you know, there's nothing that a speaker likes to hear more then the people like what he just did and say, put it on the road. So I did. I put it on the road, and I put together what we called a crash course on money. And that was very popular, and I was traveling around doing all-day seminars on that topic. And then finally it dawned on me that I really didn't know what I was talking about, because at the end of every presentation, inevitably there would be somebody that would say, well, Mr. Griffin, what you say sounds very true, and I'm very concerned. What should I do? I've got a little bit of money, and it's in retirement fund of some kind, or I've got all my money tied up in real estate, but I owe a lot of money. Should I get out of debt, and so forth? And they really thought that I was really smart, you know, because I knew about the Federal Reserve. They thought I knew about the economy, and they thought I knew about investments and all the things about which I did not know. So I stopped giving the seminars and decided it was time to go to school. So I enrolled in something called the College for Financial Planning. It's really basically a correspondence course. It's fairly prestigious. People get these designations, the CFP designation, if you can make it all the way through. It's kind of tough, even mm-hmm. though it's a correspondence course. But anyway, I did get through it, and I got my CFP designation because I wanted to figure out what was really going on in the markets of the world. And I didn't ever want to become a financial planner, but I wanted the education that came from that. So I did that, and then I got really serious about the book. That is when I began to write the book, and from that point forward, it was a 7-year project. So you see, a little chunk here and a big chunk there, it all adds up. And finally, in 1994, this huge brick materialized, and you know, 600 pages, and I could have gone on another 600. I only got about halfway through the story, and I thought, you know, if I haven't made my point clear by this point after 600 pages, another 600 isn't going to do any more. So I kind of just stopped it there, and we published it. So that's how it came about, and it was quite a learning experience for me, and turned out to be a major turning point in my life because of all the attention that this book has brought.
Sure. Well, and now 20 years later, it's on its, what, fifth or sixth edition?
It's nearing the end of its fifth edition. We're going to have to do a sixth one pretty soon. But it's about 36, 37 printings now, and Ooh. About 500,000 copies.
500,000 copies. How about that? Yeah. Well, if anybody listening hasn't bought one yet, we're going to take you up to 500,000 and another 1,000 or two.
Okay.
Yeah,
that'll work.
I refer to it as Godfather, but so much of what is in that book has now been popularized and rebroadcast from, I mean, by me, by Mike Maloney, by Jim Sinclair, by, you know, I mean, an endless stream almost of internet pundits. But we all so much of it draws back to the stuff that you first put in print 20 years ago, and so we're all very grateful for that, no question.
Well, thank you for that, Greg, but I certainly want to jump in and point out that most of the real work had already been done when I came into the field. If it hadn't been for many authors and researchers that had gone before, there's no way in the world that I could have pulled all of this together. So I just don't want anybody to think that this was a singular job on my part. My role primarily was just to try and pull it all together and organize it and retell the story in a form that might have more appeal to the average person.
And you did a wonderful job, no question about that. Well, as we move toward the questions that all of the listeners have, I just kind of wanted to ask you a couple of quick ones myself, just to kind of get your impression of things. You know, as you've laid out in the book, and as you've told folks for years, the Fed, in its role of money creation, and then, you know, getting that money levered up by its member banks, funds the deficit spending of the United States without the foreign buyers, and the deficit having exploded the way it is, it put the Fed in a situation where they've been printing money like crazy. They call it quantitative easing. They've been doing it to the tune of about $1 billion a year this year. Much was made yesterday that they're going to cut that back to a rate of 900 instead of $1 trillion. I said $1 billion, it's $1 trillion a year. They're going to cut it back to $900 billion a year, as if that's a real big change. Have I described that right? The Fed's ultimate role, would you put it that way, as kind of the of how they affect things and how they fund the government. Did I encapsulate that right?
Well, yes, you did, Craig, but that was only half of it.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the only half of the whole story. We have to remember that the Federal Reserve, we have to take a good hard look and understand what it is before we can understand what it is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because without knowing what it is, we don't know what its motives are. And if we don't understand the motives, then we'll never really appreciate the crime.
Right.
The Federal Reserve, first of all, we have to understand, is a cartel. It's not a government agency. It's a cartel. It's a private banking cartel, no different than an oil cartel or a peanut cartel, banana cartel. Happens to be a banking cartel. And like all cartels, it has one mission only, and that's to advance the interests of the members of the cartel. And it has nothing to do with helping America or improving the economy or slowing down inflation or stimulating employment or one of these other things that they constantly barrage us with to make us feel good about it. Once we understand that it is a banking cartel, then we clearly can appreciate the fact that none of these things that they're saying are true. Its sole purpose is to advance the well-being of the banks, period. 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 All right. Now, that's its motivation is to, and I'm going to say it as harshly as I know how now, is to plunder the American people legally, and they're doing an excellent job of it. Now, in order to do that, they have to go into partnership with the federal government, because a cartel cannot last very long, or monopolies cannot last very long, unless they buy government protection to give them advantage over their competition. Otherwise, competitors will come along and break the cartel or break the monopoly.
Yep.
Because the profits are so attractive that, you know, they bring in competition. Well, monopolies and cartels don't want competition, and so they always gravitate to the centers of government and seek to purchase the loyalties of the political figures to pass legislation which will give them a monopolistic stronghold so that nobody can compete with them, because it'll now be against the law to do so. So now we have this other partner in the cartel, and that's the federal government. And so what you just mentioned a moment ago is the role it serves for the federal government, for creating money for the federal government to spend without having to go to the taxpayers directly and collecting these huge amounts in the form of income taxes, excise taxes, sales taxes, and so forth, which would make the government very unpopular. So instead, they just create the money through the banking system out of literally nothing and flood it into the economy through the banks in the form of loans, so that mm-hmm. banks can collect interest on all of this huge flood of money. And so now we have the other motive, which is to finance the runaway government spending in a fashion that the taxpayers will not rebel. And that fashion, of course, is through inflation, because we're back to my original little documentary that never got produced, is that people still don't understand that the cause of inflation is the expansion of the money supply, which is done jointly by this partnership between the banks and the government. So that's the other motive. One is to create money in this ever-expanding quantity for the federal government. And the other, of course, is to make sure that all of this money that's created produces interest payments to the banking system.
Mm-hmm.
So there you've got the sort of a snapshot, an overview of the scam.
I try to explain just that, on almost a daily basis to all of my readers and subscribers, in that this nonsense that is put forth by the media, that, you know, this is all about this altruistic Federal Reserve who wants to help create jobs and spur growth. As an aside, Ed, just your opinion. I mean, when we hear financial media willingly spout that, are they just, really, there's only two options. Are they stupid or are they complicit in some regard in kind of promoting this scheme and lie?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I mean, and my answer would fluctuate between the two, depending somewhat on my mood, I think.
Yeah.
I think they are stupid, but then your point is quite well taken. They can't be that stupid.
Right.
And so we're back to the other alternative. And that is that, how do you condense this one? People have a great capacity for self-deception, especially when it's profitable to them to do so.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, I think of all of the people I know, good people, really fine people, and they're working for corrupt institutions. They're working for corporations, let's say, that they know are totally corrupt. I'm thinking of one case in particular, very, very dear lady who is a sales rep for a large pharmaceutical company. She's very high in the company now. She started off right out of college, you know, and climbed up and everything. And she went into this employee relationship with, you know, big wide eyes, thinking she was going to be helping people, you know, cure diseases and all of this wonderful stuff. And then over the years, she got to realize that this industry is totally corrupt, and they would kill hundreds of thousands of people by burying research results that shows that their drugs don't work and that they're deadly. They'll bury that research so they can push the drugs onto the market and make their $1 billion in profits. And then they think, okay, we pay $100 million in fines to the survivors of these poor people. But what the heck, we made our billion. It's just the cost of doing business. And gradually, this lady became aware that she's working in a very corrupt industry, and yet, in spite of the fact that she's a very fine person, she continues to work there because that's now her livelihood, you see. And so she never says anything really harsh about the company that she's working for, because it's just, you don't do it and keep your job. So I think there's a lot of that in the media, and I use that perhaps that was not the best example, but you see it all over the place. People rationalize because it's an income stream, and they don't want to make waves. They don't want to wind up as a bag lady on the street.
And that's actually combining the other elements, and that's probably about the most logical explanation, or the most folks fit into that category rather than the other two. Let me just ask you one last question, and then we'll get to all the listeners. I have been projecting since last summer that before Ben Bernanke left as chairman, that they would taper, if anything, so that it would accomplish for him that he would say, as his legacy, he saved everything in 2008, that they took these extraordinary measures of quantitative easing, but then before he left, set us on a path to taper and eliminate. And I didn't even think about, with the bad press that they've received, especially lately regarding all of the money printing, that to ensure the appointment of Janet Yellen, they also had to set themselves, you know, just for public relations standpoint, on this path of tapering. Anyway, this is a long question, obviously, but since they did trim what they are reporting as money printing every month yesterday from $85 billion a month to $75, some have suggested that that they're going to get out of this entirely. They're going to stop. They're going to break this relationship. They're going to stop the funding of the, you know, printing money and funding the debt, that even for their own sake, that they don't want to saddle their balance sheet with trillions and trillions more of, you know, essentially worthless paper. Do you have any thoughts on, I mean, is there any way that could be the case, or are they just going to continue down this path for as long?
Well,
as
Well, yeah, I think that that the Fed will stop expanding the money supply is about as likely as that the spider will stop eating flies.
Yeah,
that's what the Fed was designed to do. That's what the spider has to do because it's a spider. The Federal Reserve is a banking cartel, and to continue to serve the interests of the banks, they have to expand the money supply. If they if they limit the money supply or contract it in any way, now that's hurting the cash flow for the banks. And anybody who is a chairman of the Fed that advocated or implemented such a policy would soon be out on the street, because that's not what it is designed to do. So my feeling is that no, I think they'll do some public relations work. They'll do some some damage control. They'll try and make it look like they're really doing their best, to improve the economy. And they're not doing a good job, but at least they're sincere and they're trying, and they're trying this and they're trying that. But the poor guys are up against, so many things. That's the image they want to create, is that they're really sincere. Maybe they're not doing a good job, but nobody else could either. This is the kind of image they want to project. So I'm perhaps a little jaundiced. I've been watching these people for too long. I know what kind of creature this is. I know what it has to do to survive, and I don't think that includes anything that will benefit the American people.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And this idea that they would stop buying bonds, which would keep them from printing money, that certainly seems like that just isn't going to happen.
Yeah, well, you have to remember, too, that the Fed is now completely broken free from any legal restraints. The Fed now can create money in many ways that would probably be contrary to the terms of its original charter. It has completely relaxed the rules and the ratios. And now the Fed is even funding foreign banks, as you know. It's sending a lot of money into foreign countries, which is by no stretch of the imagination. Can you imagine how that would be covered by the Federal Reserve Charter? And so they have ways of inflating the money supply in America by directing it through other channels other than just through the window, opening the window, so to speak, or buying bonds, the traditional methods. They can subsidize corporations. They can create credits through the IMF. They've got all these ways that we don't even know about and can't discover, and they're not going to tell us. So it's not just going to the discount window or buying bonds from the federal government. They have other ways as well.
Well, and that's a perfect segue to the very first question on the list, Ed. This comes from a guy listening by the name of Rob, who his question is, Ron Paul exposed that the Federal Reserve had secretly bailed out many banks around the world to the tune of roughly $16 trillion. He just wants to know that given this and the other things we continue to learn about their insidious dealings, any chance you're going to write a follow-up book?
Well, actually, there's no need for a follow-up book because it's all in the creature. The only thing that's not in the creature is what happened yesterday afternoon. But what happened yesterday afternoon is just more of the same. And that's the reason that I am looking at a sixth edition, because I have, in fact, for five editions, updated the original draft of the creature to include these very things that Ron Paul is talking about. In fact, the whole chapter on bailouts was drastically rewritten and updated after 2008, when the bailout play was accelerated. So there's no need to write a new book. There is a need, of course, to keep the old one up to date, which I try to do, and I imagine, I'm guessing that sometime in 2014 we will have a sixth edition to do exactly that. I am working on another book, but it is not directly related to the Federal Reserve. If you can imagine my mindset when I say this, I think it's even more important than the Federal Reserve. It's hard to imagine what could be more important than that, because money is at the base of almost everything in our lives. But the topic of the book is, what are we going to do about it? The topic is, what caused this in the first place? How come we, as Americans, who had the greatest running start in the world, the greatest political system the world had ever seen so far, wasn't perfect, but boy, as a beta model, it was really good. How come we let that slip out of our fingers? How come we let people like the Federal Reserve, the banks, how come we let them take that away from us? What were the flaws in the system that allowed that? And what are we going to do about it? Could we rebuild if we have a chance? Could we rebuild? And if so, what would we do to make it better for the next time around? That's the topic of my next book. And I'm a little embarrassed to say that I've been working on it for too long. I started to write on it on this thing the day after 9/11. And so you see, I've been engaged in this for quite a while. But anyway, that's the answer to the question. I'm not going to do a new book on the Fed, but I am working on something which tentatively is entitled "The Future Is Calling," an invitation to change the world.
Well, I know we just met, but I'm now going to order you to work day and night, 24 hours a day. And get that.
Well, I'm already doing that.
Okay, good. I just can't wait to read it. I mean, fingers crossed, maybe sometime in 2014.
I would love to say so. In fact, I have been sort of dormant on that for so long. I might write a page here or a paragraph there. Yeah. But now I'm really into it. The last seems like the last 3 or 4 months, it's caught fire. On an interesting side topic, the issue of private property. I realize that I have to include a very good chapter, my best shot at least, on this issue of private property, which has come under fire a lot in recent years. You know, people say, well, you can't own anything. You can't own the earth. You have no right to the air and the water and the land and so forth. And so I've been trying to – that issue has rekindled my passion to get to work. And so it's exciting.
Yeah. I very much look forward to reading it when it's completed. It dovetails into, I guess, in a sense, an extra. I'm going to skip one for a second, and I'll come back to Keg. If you're listening, I'll come back to your question in a second. But this, what you just mentioned, dovetails into a question from one of our contributors who goes by the name of Pining, for short. He wants to thank you, frankly, for all you've done. But then he goes on to say, 20 years ago, when you wrote The Creature, you made some predictions and claims that at the time seemed somewhat unlikely. But in the time since, virtually everything you predicted has proven nearly accurate. Please tell us what you think might happen over the next 20 years as regards to the Fed and sound money.
I hate that question. for two reasons. Actually, I'm not so good at timetables. I have pretty good track record for knowing or anticipating, I should say, what's going to happen, but I have a very bad track record regarding when it's going to happen. I usually am more alarmed about the pending doom sort of thing. In other words, back in the 1960s, I didn't think that the system could hold together much longer. You know, I felt like Scotty in Star Trek saying, "Captain, the ship is, she's coming apart. I don't think I can hold her together much longer."
Right.
You know? I always thought the system was coming apart in the 60s. Well, it's held together pretty good. But anyway, it is coming apart, all right. It's just that it's still holding together a little longer. But anyway, back to the main question. The reason I don't like it is because I think that we have a lot less time than most people think we do, but there again, I could be wrong on that. But the other reason I don't like it is because it's not a pretty picture. When people ask me that question, I feel that I have an obligation to be totally honest about it and not just pump sunshine out there and say, well, don't worry about it. You know, Americans have had problems before, and we've always come back, haven't we? You know, this is America, and you know, da da da. And I don't think that's the case right now. I think that we are in a very precarious position of losing it all if we don't reverse the trend. Let's answer the question this way. There are two possible scenarios. If we do not reverse the trend and things continue to go as they have been going, which means if we continue under the leadership that we have had all of this time, under this collectivist leadership that we find in both of the major political parties, if the limitation of our choices and solutions is which party are you going to vote for, if that's the limit of our resources for solving the problem, then everything is going to continue as it has been. And under that pessimistic scenario, I see just one crisis after another finally wearing down the American people to the point where they will accept totalitarian rule as a superior alternative to chaos and riots in the street and starvation and all of that sort of thing. Terrorism, crime, drugs, all of these things that scare us to death will be so rampant that people will say, I don't care about my liberties. Just come give me some food and a place to get in out of the cold.
That's
the sort of thing we're heading to. And under that kind of a condition, you know, who even wants to be alive under those conditions? So that's not a pretty picture. And people will not only welcome martial law, they'll demand it. And that's what I'm afraid is looming ahead. Now, that's assuming that nothing changes. Now, is it possible to change that? And the answer is yes, it is possible. The question is it going to be easy? No, but it's possible, and that's the pretty good answer, really. It's possible to change it if we do what we know we have to do. And in my view, that is simply we've got to, those of us who can see what's going on and have a better view than just more of the same, we need to get organized. We have to join together. We have to go back into the power centers of society. By that I mean those groups and organizations that determine the policy of the nation, such as political parties, labor unions, educational institutions, media centers, all of the power centers of society that people follow. And we have to take them back because all of them, the big ones, have been literally captured at the top by people who want to see exactly what is happening today. This is the plan for them.
Right.
They benefit from this. We don't, but they do. And they're the ones that are calling the shots. They're the ones that are dominant in government and in the media, educational system. Everywhere you look, you find people at the tops of these power centers who like it just fine the way it is. They want more of it. And the only solution is to get those people out of their positions of influence and replace them with people who have no axe to grind, who want to see freedom restored and want privacy restored. And want personal security. They want the dignity of the individual. They don't want to be just melted into a collective pot and, you know, part of the group. So this is the challenge, and it can be done. And I appreciate that question because back in 2002, I created an organization that was designed to bring that about. And it's called Freedom Force International. And I urge anybody that's interested in becoming part of that kind of a solution to go to the internet and just look us up and check out this strategy that we've developed. And that's freedomforceinternational.org. It can be done. That's the answer. That's the positive side. It may not be done by the next election.
Yeah.
In fact, it won't be done by the next election. But it will be done in the next generation or two if we get busy with it, and that's pretty good.
But I fear, as I sense you do too, that it's going to be very difficult to slow that momentum. The acceptance of a totalitarian, you know, a tyranny, for the reasons you mentioned, or, you know, just growing civil unrest at the way the middle class has been squeezed and gets continued to be squeezed, you know, by these policies, by this policies of inflating the money supply and how that all trickles down. Do you think, Ed, and this goes kind of the next question from a contributor named Irrational Mind, the Fed almost has to understand this, don't they? That the money supply cannot just simply expand indefinitely. I mean, Weimar Republic being a classic example. Do they just think they're smart enough that they can continue to manage it gradually and just extend things forever? Or do you think they really don't understand? They don't realize that it can't expand indefinitely?
Well, there's an assumption in that question. It cannot expand indefinitely if you want a system that is beneficial for the people. But if you don't give a damn about the people, if your motive is not to take care of the people but to preserve your favored position as the elite, Now you have a different answer to the question. Yes, the money supply can be expanded indefinitely, and it will indefinitely push the people down into a position of subservience and dependence on you or the state, which you can control. So it depends on what your goal is. If I were on the other side of this issue, I could say, of course, we can expand the money supply indefinitely. Who cares if we drive millions of people into the dirt? That's where they belong.
Right. That's what they think.
That's what they think.
Okay. I have a kind of a conglomeration of questions. There's probably three or four with this theme, so I'll just kind of put it all together into one. You know, we're approaching the 100-year anniversary. The Fed was created to be around for 100 years, right? I guess we all assume it's reauthorized and going to keep on going.
It's been reauthorized, yes.
Yeah. So do you think, I guess I try to encapsulate this, have you sensed the awareness over 20 years? I mean, do you sense that more people at least are kind of waking up to how this whole thing works? Do you think there is an Andrew Jackson type figure? Will it take an Andrew Jackson type figure? Would it take some type of a awakening to be a driving force to end the Fed eventually? I mean, do you have any opinion on what it might take or how that could eventually come about?
Well, yes, I have some views on that too. And as before, this has a positive and a possible negative answer depending on what happens. You know, yes. First of all, it's clear that there is a rather marked and dramatic rise in awareness of the problem with the Fed. People even know how to say the phrase Federal Reserve System now, whereas when my book was first published, you'd be surprised how many people said, "What is that?" Yeah. You know, they didn't understand. What is that again? Right. Did I hear about that somewhere? So even that is a big step forward that people know about it. Not only do they know about it, but it's in the news. Not only is it in the news, but it's in the news in a critical fashion. People are unhappy with it. Okay, all of that is good compared to what it was 20 years ago. But now as to understanding what's wrong with it exactly, we have a long way to go with that. Yeah. I see a lot of these very well-intentioned, good people out demonstrating, you know, they're going to end the Fed, but the placards they're waving, you know, tell us that they're upset with Wall Street. They think that the Federal Reserve is a result of unbridled capitalism, you know, and they think that the solution, of course, is to bring down capitalism and restore it with socialism or communism or something else, some ism, and they don't realize that the Federal Reserve is the epitome of these things that they're already asking for. The Federal Reserve is not an outgrowth of the free market competition. It's the opposite of that. It's the outgrowth of monopoly and cartels, which have gone into partnership with government to solidify their grip over society. And so these people that want to, protest against Wall Street, and they're demanding, what are they demanding? Are they really demanding an end to the Fed? No, not really. They're demanding, most of these people are demanding more government controls over the Fed. Yeah. In other words, they're demanding more of exactly the same thing that's caused the problem. Yeah. So they are going to be used as unwitting dupes in this thing. And they could well be cannon fodder that would generate a lot of support for more government controls of the Fed, nationalization of the banks. Maybe it'll be time to turn all of this over to the UN and bigger governmental control at the international level. Let the International Monetary Fund move in and take over. And all these people will be cheering and say, we finally get rid of the Fed. And they don't realize that the Fed just morphed into something bigger and more ugly than it was in the first place.
Yeah.
So that is our challenge, our opportunity, and our danger right now. The movement is growing, but we have a lot of work to do to make sure that it is directed in the correct way and not just becoming a surge of anger based on ignorance, so that it can be used against the people.
Ed, you're being extraordinarily generous with your time, and I know I just can't thank you enough, and I'm getting a lot of comments from folks that just think this is wonderful and very appreciative. Let me just ask you one more question.
All right.
there's a lot of talk, I'm sure you've seen it, about Bitcoin and alternative currencies these days. I just open-ended question to you. I mean, what do you think of it, of alternative currencies like that? Do they pose a viable alternative? Are they just too much of a threat that they'll be quickly marginalized or taxed or made illegal? I mean, do you have any thoughts on this whole craze?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have lots of thoughts. The idea of alternative therapies, I switched my brain over
gotcha.
To cancer. It's a very parallel path, isn't it? Because,
yeah.
You know, I do a lot of work in the cancer field, and they talk a lot about alternative treatments and therapies. It's the same issue, really. What we are calling alternatives really are the superior approach, and the fact that they are the alternatives and not the dominant therapies or the dominant currencies is kind of a sad commentary in itself. I think that one of the principles that we need to appreciate is the value of freedom of choice in society. And that's one of the planks, by the way, of our creed of freedom that was published by the Freedom Force International that I mentioned a moment ago. One of the planks is freedom of choice. And when you think about that, it's a very important concept, because it means that those of us who are individualists and believe in freedom do not – we think we're smart, of course. Unlike the collectivists that say, well, we're smarter than everybody, and therefore we're going to pass a law and force everybody to do what we know is best for them. That's the collectivist attitude. We, on the other side, say, well, we're smarter than everybody too, but – we also know that we may not be smarter than everybody, and therefore we don't believe in forcing everybody to do what we think they should do. We believe that they should have freedom of choice to make their own decisions. Well, that's a very important principle, and you can apply it to health and cancer, or you can apply it to currencies. And now that's the issue. I think that if we follow that freedom of choice principle, it just is logical that people ought to be able to use anything they wish as money, and not have it crammed down their throats by government. Governments love to issue money, and then they pass a legal tender law which requires everybody to use their money or else go to prison. Mm-hmm. And now, if the money were sound, if it were fully backed by gold or silver, you wouldn't have to force anybody to use it. They'd be in line to use it. They'd
exactly.
say, I want that money. You see, the fact that you have to force people to use your money means that your money's no darn good. So I'm all for alternative currencies, as they call them. I think that's the way society should be run, and we should have many currencies to choose from. And I know from my study of history, that in every case that's been true, people have always gravitated to money which is backed by something of intrinsic value like gold or silver. And they don't have to be forced to do so. It's their own freedom of choice that makes that decision. So I'm all for that. And Bitcoins is one of those. And I think that Bitcoins, I'm all for it. It's certainly superior to the Federal Reserve notes because it is limited in quantity, at least for now. And they say it could never be increased in quantity. I'm not so sure about that, but let's assume that that's the case. The only thing I find wrong with Bitcoins is it has nothing of intrinsic value behind it. You know, if the government should move in, let's say tomorrow, and say, well, we're going to close the internet down to all transactions dealing with Bitcoins, boom, it's over. I mean, there's no value there left. Nobody's got a Bitcoin in a coffee can.
Right.
And so then they lose. But then there are dangers all the way. No matter where you turn, if you had a coffee can full of gold and silver, somebody could come in and steal it too, and then it's gone. So there are dangers no matter what you do. It's just that I personally, I feel that the dangers involved with having solid assets like gold or silver or something else, maybe a warehouse full of cheap white wine, something that has intrinsic value, that just can't be created out of nothing, that's the best way that we could possibly think of to go in preserving our assets.
I agree wholeheartedly. All right, Ed, you've got the website Reality Zone, right? Is it realityzone.com?
Yes, realityzone.com. That's our commercial site where we try and sell things.
Okay.
We have We have over 100 books and recordings on topics such as this.
So we've
and then our think tank, site is freedomforceinternational.org. And that's for people who really want to make a difference.
And everybody listening can see the links to those sites, and I strongly encourage everybody to check it out, just as I strongly encourage everybody to pick up the fifth edition, but then also the sixth edition of The Creature from Jekyll Island, and then keep your eyes and ears open for this pending new book you're talking about. Lastly, Ed, I just want to ask a favor of everybody listening. Ed has a longtime assistant whose name is Joan Hunter, who is an artist, but fighting her own battle against a number of health issues. A very nice lady, and I wanted to help her in some way. Ed, tell everybody about Joan, her battle, and her son.
I wish we had more time for that, but basically the story is Joan, I've known Joan, first of all, for many years, but she's been working for me as my personal assistant for 9 years. She's a very gracious lady, very beautiful lady, and I mention beauty because unfortunately she's developed some cancers on her face and around her eye, and it's a tragic thing to see this disfiguration that she's had to put up with. And of course, a lot of people will develop cancers like that, but in Joan's case, it's something very unusual. You know, cancer often is a result of a poor lifestyle and poor diet, a breakdown in the natural in the immune system, and things that can be related in some way to what we do or what we don't do. And it's not just something that happens to us. In Joan's case, she's the last person you would expect to see with cancers like this, because her lifestyle is just pristine. She's vegan. You should see what she eats. It's nothing but salads and good food, organic this, and it drives me crazy. I mean, no, I'm all for it, and I try my best to keep up with her, but she's so far ahead, it's impossible. And so she's the last person that you could say, well, she has a bad lifestyle and her diet is no good. And it turns out that when she came to Los Angeles some years ago, she lived in the Santa Susana area near the Simi Hills, and that's where Rocketdyne had a facility up on the top of the mountain range there. And unbeknownst to most people, they were experimenting with a nuclear reactor up there, and nobody knew it. And they had a couple of accidents and a couple of spills, and they never told anybody. And the whole area became highly radioactive. And she went up there 3 or 4 times a week and hiked in those trails up very close to that facility, not knowing that she was being exposed to this radioactive waste that was that had been spilled into the area. And later on, they tried to remove all of this, and they didn't do a good job. They didn't tell anybody that they were digging it up, and the dust was flying around, and they were hauling it away in trucks and, you know, and not telling anybody. And actually, this facility was later bought by Boeing Company, and people sued Boeing as the new owner of this this facility, because a lot of people had proven in court that they developed cancer as a result of being exposed to that. Boeing settled, I think it was a $9 million suit or something like that, relatively small amount of money considering, but still it was proven in court that they were, or the facility was responsible. So anyway, to make a long story short, Joan is trying to go to the Boeing Corporation in court and challenging them to at least help pay for her medical bills. And she doesn't have a lot of money, and I wanted to bring her story to the public and see if people would help. And on the bright side of this, if you could call it a bright side, is Joan is a kind of person that doesn't ask for charity. She doesn't want charity. And fortunately, she is a magnificent artist. She has been producing some of the most jaw-dropping art you could possibly imagine. And what Joan wants is for people to want her art. If we want to help her, she just wants us to come to her art gallery, which she has on the internet, and pick out some painting that she has done and buy it and give it to somebody or put it in the home. I have several of her pieces of art in my home, and I'm very proud of them, as anybody would be. So anyway, that's the story, and that's the pitch. If we want to help Joan, and I'm sure most people will, if you want to see her complete story with pictures of all of this, come to our website. Let's see.
And I have a link here, too.
Oh, you do? Oh, if you can put it up, that would be super.
I have a link to a homepage of hers. It's on something called Penny Pup. And it's got her sketches, her bio, her gallery, contact her. And I would just, again, I mean, it's nice to have this platform to really try to help people. And if we can help Joan, I know we've got art lovers out there. I've got people that know people that are art lovers that need a gift this holiday season. So please, I just want everybody listening to check out Joan's work and see if you can.
Okay. Well, if you've got those links, that would be great. And you just take a look at some of her art. It's just absolutely amazing. And I don't know what she's doing working for me. She should have been she's making a great name for herself. Well, she has a pretty good name. I just dug into my files last night, and I found some video that I took a few years ago at one of her exhibits at a gallery, and the place was packed. I mean, people were there. You know, this is Joan Glover's art, and they were looking at her pieces on exhibit. So she's got a pretty good following. So that's it. Joan needs our help, and it's an easy way to help, because you will want at least one of her paintings, and they're not very expensive.
Well, and Ed, we need your help too. So get back to work.
Okay, I'm back to work.
and finish writing that new book and everything else. Gosh, I can't thank you enough. I know I speak on behalf of everybody listening. Just can't thank you enough for spending some time here in Turdville. I hope we can do it again sometime in 2014. You can bring us up to speed on how things are going. But thank you very, very much for spending some time. And I wish you a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, all that kind of stuff.
Well, thank you. Same to you and to all of your supporters. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Ed. We'll hopefully speak again soon. Have a great day.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Bye.